Kaka is a Minority language spoken in the Northern Cook Islands. It's approximately 5 days' travel by cargo boat from Rarotonga, the main island of the Cook Islands. Approximately 500 speakers live on the main island, called Wale, at the top there. And the two uninhabited islands in the back of the main island are used as food reserves. So the total land area is about 2.5 square miles. There are approximately 3,000 people of Pukapukan descent in New Zealand and a further 2,000 possibly in Australia. Can you all hear me at the back? Thanks. So second generation migrants usually have only a passive knowledge of the language that's in New Zealand, but I guess there'd be about 2,000 to 3,000 speakers worldwide in total. So our role in learning and documenting the language has spanned 30 years. So I was thinking of the contrast with the last talk and continuation. Continuation is a relative notion, I guess. So I've gone grey over this project. in our first trip in 1981, it was for our master's projects. My husband and I were both studying. I was doing a master's on the language, and Kevin was doing a master's on ethnomusicology on the music. So we've had a joint sort of alliance ever since. Several other trips. I'm thinking here of the issues that come up, just sort of the lead up to this talk here. The issues that come up, even in terms of ethics for the project, this is a bilingualism study that I did while I was on the island. And thinking about, none of the participants even wanted to sign a consent form. They said, what's the point in that? We don't need to sign this. Yeah, so very interesting contrasts. My husband was there with a Category 4 cyclone, hurricane, that devastated the island in 2005. And we more recently went back to the island for our last summer in order to, while we were there, we were working with a scientist from Rarotonga looking at the biology, the correct identification of fish and birds and other species. That's one of the focuses. Also, the main purpose of this trip was 150 years celebration of the coming of the first mission teacher to Pukapuka. So not only have we been involved in language documentation, but now into advisors to a Bible translation project that the community initiated. So just a bit of a blast from the past. Here's the original dictionary manuscript done on Gestetner, then photocopied with still the correct the question with still here you can see some crossings out. That was the first edition. Then Bob Shue here from Hawaii helped us to put it into Lexware program and Spitball printouts. And then we found another a version of Pearl's dictionary held in the Victoria University at Wellington, published that independently because it reflected her fieldwork. And so although it was quite small, we thought we'd publish that independently before we added it into the dictionary. And all the time we were getting Lexware problems, and I thought, I'll put up this old email from 97 to Bob here just to so thank you, Bob, for your involvement in this project over a number of years. Thank you so much. And then we put it into Shoebox and Toolbox and Lexic Pro. So the outcomes in academic sense have been a dictionary and a grammar, but because of the longevity of this project, if you like, there has been a lot of community participation, and our role has changed from perhaps initially the language chose me, But eventually it has come to the community directs our paths. So there's tensions even in, you know, the community wants to control what sort of materials are made accessible, and we honour their wishes as, yeah. So we've also got a collection of 200 corpus, corpus of 200 traditional chants, some of which date back more than 150 years, according to the genealogical records. So what I want to talk about today is language change versus language conservatism, and are our language documentation projects speeding up language change? In the on the island, sort of over 30 years, I've noticed there's a changing attitude on the island towards the migrant community in New Zealand. I didn't notice this in 1981, but in the more recent field trip that we made, the very first set of speeches in one of the village speeches for the 140 Pukapukans that came at the same time as us was, "What are you Aucklanders doing on the island? Don't you think you're going to come and control us?" So there's a tension here between the migrant population and their view of development. They come to think of not just language development, but economic development and all sorts of social development and recording of and all sorts of areas that the Auckland community are interested in, many of which we're not even involved in. But the attitudes towards the language is also quite different, and the use of language on the island is different. In Auckland, there's a in Auckland the community is more conservative, whereas on the island there's more progress. Does that sound strange? So the migrant community is conservative in that they're wanting to retain their traditions, go back to the old, reinvent old words. And the population on the island is quite happy to code mix, to add in Rarotongan words, not so much English words, but yes, Rarotongan words. And there's a degree of code mixing to the point where you can hardly tell what language is being spoken. Is it Pukapukan? Is it Rarotongan? It's actually neither. Or, yes, it's a modern version of Pukapukan. Sometimes the grammar... So what I think there is happening is that there's a continuum on the island between pure Pukapukan and pure Rarotongan, and in the middle there's a merging where you have, well, to this end, there's Rarotongan grammar with a lot of Pukapukan words, and at this end it's Pukapukan grammar with some Rarotongan words. And so the language that's spoken in the house is towards this end of the Pukapukan spectrum, and I'll talk about... so here's a couple of pictures of the Auckland community, just for your interest. It's an annual festival, and the translation team. So on the island, so here, just talking about diglossia for a moment, it's not exact diglossia, it's not very clear-cut, but it's characterised by a situation in which the national language, Cook Islands Māori, is used for religious, political and educational functions, although to a certain extent, sometimes a minister will lapse into Pukapukan and telling an anecdote or an illustration in the church service. And in meetings, some people will speak in Pukapukan, but mostly it's in some version of Rarotongan. No English spoken on the island. I haven't heard English spoken on the island. And because we've learned the language, most of our fieldwork is done in Pukapukan language. Compare this with Auckland, where Pukapukan is spoken in the home. Yes, the main domains for Pukapukan in church and in meetings, but I should have put here, English is also the predominant language, but Rarotongan is missing out in Auckland. So the one of the recent studies of Cook Islands language in Manukau City shows that Cook Islands is one of the most endangered of the four majority Polynesian languages that are spoken in Auckland. And I guess this is adding to that endangerment, in that a minority language that's fairly strong in terms of solidarity is also not using the national language in the migrant situation. Okay, so on to the role of the dictionary is quite often, it's interesting in the Pukupukan community in Auckland, as we're doing translation, sometimes if you ask about a word, they'll run to the dictionary instead of thinking in their own minds, what does this word mean? As if the dictionary captures the real language, which is certainly not the case. There's so many gaps in it. The other question is, what is the role of the Bible Translation Project and the religious leaders in how the language is changing? In the 1970s, I remember my main language consultant became like a friend, and he was one of the first people to pray in Pukupukan. And there was such a twittering in the congregation of laughing when they did this. But nowadays, some of the ministers in Auckland are more and more speaking in Pukupukan rather than in Rarotongan. So there is, I think that this, in fact, the Bible Translation Project has some role, maybe in revitalising, yes, but what I'm questioning is, are we speeding up language change by this process? And in what ways is the language changing? Well, as far as the sounds of the language are concerned, definitely there's a change in people's expectations about the orthography. All of the foreign sounds that are found in the Cook Islands Māori Bible are being eliminated. The Pukupukans want to see just the Pukupukan sounds recorded orthographically. In terms of actual sounds themselves, I think there are changes in the way that the language is being pronounced in Auckland, but it's not related to the Bible translation. It's more related to interference from English, things like aspiration perhaps, or loss of the definitive accent and things like that, I think, are happening, but not related to the documentation process itself. So I think this is a fairly stable area of the language in terms of the documentation process. However, the grammar, I've noticed that there's quite a few areas in which the grammar is being affected. Now, traditionally, in the chants and old documents, legacy documents that we've got, there's a lot of CIA suffixes, if you know Oceanic languages, so the transitivizer or the passivizer. There's a whole range, that some of which were conditioned phonologically in the past. Modern language tends to use ina, and also just the vowel, but they also use this old one when they're trying to sound traditional. And there's a merging of the two, like a vog, you know, like a nina. Instead of fog, do you get vog here? Now, what's happening in the religious and formal discourse, I notice, is that they tend to go back to this one, so this older one. Although this is very modern, and you hear it all the time in conversation, I believe that this one is not favoured because it is too like the national language. So, similarly, the negative imperative, the way you say don't do something, this first one at the top here, I'd only ever seen once on Pukapuka, and that was on a do not smoke sign on the government house. It was sort of tongue-in-cheek, used the old language. In the 1970s, I heard it a couple of times in religious language, but now it's being used all the time. It's like a reinvention of the old. And these ones that sound, this one sounds a bit more traditional, this one's very common, and in modern spoken language, and so is the Rarotongan form. In the religious texts that are being written down, the old form is favoured. This one is totally eliminated because, again, it sounds too Rarotongan. It sounds like someone else's language. In other words, there's a degree of let's be different, there's solidarity, there's all sorts of things that are happening in the migrant community that want to make the language different. There's lots of new vocabulary items coming up, some are new compounds. This one uses an old particle. Although you might think, oh, this looks fine, these are old words that mean completely different things to kingdom. So they're new compounds and collocations that are being developed. There's new meanings being given to words. For instance, this is an interesting one for the Māori. When we're translating the Lord's Prayer, there's such a lot of discussion about how you translate the word forgive. Now, there's all sorts of metaphorical ways, like to clean or to scrub or whatever, that are used in people's prayers and in conversation. But what people wanted to put in originally was this word muluna. And mulu actually means to clean the inside out of a tuna fish and to turn it inside out, which sounds fine metaphorically, but the primary meaning is to do that, and the secondary meaning that's being developed has to be taught to people. So, you know, as a linguist, I'm thinking, hang on a minute. What is our role, is the question in this whole thing. Some of the words have been brought back into the language through singing styles. This is a common word in Kukapukan and in Cook Islands Māori to mean begin, but this is an old word found in the chants that has now been reinvented over the last, say, 10 years. This is getting a new meaning, and this one again getting a new meaning, because the word that's commonly used to lie in Pukapukan sounds too much like the Cook Islands Māori form. Here's another example, common word. This is very interesting because kite is a Pan-Pacific, Pan-Polynesian word to see. But because it sounds like Cook Islands Māori, when they read their work to edit it, they think, oh no, this sounds like Cook Islands Māori, we've got to get rid of this word. So they make up they use all sorts of other words. This is also a common word to look at, that's fine. But this suffix, again, old-fashioned suffixes that are coming back into play. And even, so I brought this word because it's not a religious word at all. It's just the word to write. Now, in the 1970s, 1980s, when we were working with people to start with, they were using these words, means to scribble or to cut, because originally writing was on leaves, and that was the first writing that was sent to Reverend Buzzacott on the ship, was on a leaf. And so that took over in the 70s, but the common word in everyday speaking was the word that was similar to the Cook Islands Māori word, and that was Cook Islands Māori. But just in the last maybe 5 or 8 years or so, this word has come into play, and I think it's a borrowing from other people's knowledge of Polynesian languages. I'm sure it wasn't in Pukapuka to start with, even though I know that it goes back earlier than Pukapuka. So the attitudes, I've spoken to people in Auckland, the people on the team, the old people, they say, this is the real Pukapukan language. But some of the younger, at least a couple of the younger mothers that I've spoken to, who I've developed a close relationship with, and they can tell me no instead of just agreeing, she said to me, she thinks a new language is developing. They're making up a new language for us. So I want to, and now I know that this talk has focused on some of the issues that have been raised in Bible translation itself, but I think it brings out this idea of the good, the poetic, the literary form of the language leading back to the past, and how people want to keep the old language alive. And there's always going to be a tension between whether that's going to be natural and clear. Now, what I want to know, and obviously it reflects the migrant conservatism, but what I'm really interested in, is this because the written register is developing, and will it rectify itself? And it reminds me a bit of what Rob Borowski wrote about social anthropology on Puka Puka, where traditional knowledge was being recreated. And it brings up this whole question of what is our role as linguists or anthropologists in this process? I firmly believe in non-prescriptivism, and yet it brings up the idea that we need to also teach about language change as part of our documentation process. And what else was I going to say? And maybe even I found that we need to actually teach a little bit about comparative linguistics. Like, this is a word that's spoken all through Polynesia. Why are you wanting to eliminate it? It doesn't make the difference in their hearts. But so I'm thinking our role as linguists needs to be educative as well. That's it.
Thanks very much. We have about 10 minutes for questions, and I'll let you choose who you want to talk to.
Hi. I'm Claire Ramsey from the University of California, San Diego, and I'm wondering about the writing system. You mentioned the writing system is emergent, or the written register is emergent, but how long have they had a writing system? Is there a traditional writing system?
We've been involved in working on the development of the orthography. They've had a writing system for Cook Islands Maori for a long time.
Is that what was written on the leaf?
No. That
was
just
written on the leaf.
I don't have a copy of it, but it was recorded in 1860 something by Luca Manuai, who went to Puka Puka, and he just wrote. He must have written something quite long, because he said something like, "Send my wife. Everything's all right here." And so Buzzacott had stayed on the ship, and everyone thought that he was going to be killed, but he wasn't.
And was that written in?
It must have been. He was an Aitutakian, so he was educated at Takamoa, the theological college there. So he would have known how to write Rarotonga, and he would have written in Rarotonga. But the Pukapukans knew that was writing. They were surprised at the change in Buzzacott's behaviour when he looked at the leaf. That was their first exposure to anything written. From the 1980s, the school teachers have started to teach in Pukapukan language at about grade 3 level upwards. Until grade 3, and then they changed to the national language and into English. Later on at secondary school level, it's English. But there's still ongoing discussions about the orthography, like macronization, word division, all sorts of that stuff. We've done our apprenticeship with it.
There was another question.
Yes. I can see that the language, just from the name, has a lot of replicated patterns.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever done some studies on the
replication
system?
Yes.
And how does it work? Is it a full replication, partial?
Full and partial, you can talk to me later about grammar if you like. That's my passion.
I would agree with what you say that the documentation is affecting language change. I'm not sure I would agree that it's speeding up language change. I mean, it seems like it's taking language change in a different direction toward conservatism, away from, or maybe at the same time as, the development of the mixed language, which I see as being island kind of language change?
That's on the island. Yeah, I think it's speeding up language change back to the future. The question is, will it actually speed up the death of language as well? Because if what's being produced in literary forms is less accessible to the modern migrant youth, they will give up quicker and just use English. So I think it really needs these formal texts need to be very much balanced by informal texts that show the language in a completely different use. And I didn't want to touch on that because I was focusing on, you know, what's our role as linguists? Does anyone have any feedback on that?
That's a good question. I think as a linguist, I mean, there is nothing you can do. The language is, it is a kind of dynamism that you just need to observe and account for. That is my feeling about it. And I also had another question. What do you mean by modern? Does it have to do with generation of speakers?
I was thinking of language, colloquial language spoken today. That's what I mean by modern. I didn't mean progressive, if that's what I mean.
We just have a couple more minutes. Is there
about the role of linguists? Here you use very often the term consultant for the native speakers, but I think it should be the other way around. And I was invited to be a consultant for the Samoans and to write the grammar of the Samoan language and with Samoan teachers in the Samoan language, so a monolingual grammar and a monolingual dictionary. And as a consultant then, I suggested that for the grammar we take adaptations from the English terminology, because it, like noun and verb, etc., because the children have to learn these terms anyway, so it's better for them to learn these terms in an adapted by loan words adapted to the Samoan phonology. But the Samoans then decided, no, they don't want that. They want to have real Samoan words. And then, for instance, instead of Papikale, which was meant to be a particle, and my team of 10 teachers agreed to Papikale, the whole committee of school inspectors, or folky people, agreed on a term which means woodships, because they wanted to have indigenous words. Mm-hmm. And of course, as a consultant, I had to say, yes, of course, and we integrate this into the grammar and call the particle, not particle, but woodchip. So my role as a linguist is as a consultant. They wanted to have the dictionary written without any glottal stops, which is disastrous, because the glottal stop is a phoneme. But there was a law in Samoa in the 60s that's forbidden to write glottal stops in school materials, because the glottal stop is only written for the white people so that they can read Samoan. Yeah?
I'll just have
but
to cut you off here. There was one more question in the back,
okay,
and then we have to wrap up.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Kia ora, I'm
Rachel
from the University of Auckland. I come from South Auckland, where the highest percentage of Cook Island as well, and it is a real problem when children can't speak Cook Island. And it's also leading a lot into youth crime in Pacific Island. Children who begin to have identity issues, and Cook Island youth gangs is one of the biggest youth gangs. So that whole link between language and culture and identity is huge. My children are trilingual. They speak Samoan and they speak Māori, and I think language is very important. But I just had a question, and I may have missed it, and apologies for coming a little late. But if you're documenting your orthography now, where did the letter Y come from?
And it wasn't me that made that up.
Yeah, and the second part to my question is, I kind of think that the role of linguists is to tell the whole story. You know, you need to tell the whole story about language across Polynesia so that people can make their own decisions about how they want it documented, because I haven't seen the letter Y anywhere else.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of in the Polynesia, the little dabbling I've done in Polynesian languages, so to start saying this is a separate language when it could actually just be a dialect that someone, possibly, I don't know, that someone has chosen to put a letter Y in and then make it look like another language and then misinform the locals that it could be another language, I think is it's not right. So I do think we need to, you know, tell the whole story, because I haven't seen a little why.
Yeah, I think as linguists we're often stuck with stuff that's historical, like the English spellings, for instance, that are just historical relics, if you like, and they're not phonemic. The Y dates back to Treger's first glossary. Frisbee used it in his Beachcomber novels, and I think it relates to the palatalization of the interdental fricative. I've just found in BBM a couple of days ago, in Pill's handwriting, saying that the letter, well, let's say Y, that she wrote as Greek theta, in fact, is pronounced as the sound as in thy, T-H-Y,
yeah.
Which means it was voiced, not voiceless, and I've been struggling all these years thinking, how would it change from voiceless to voiced? and now I know it was voiced when Pearl heard it.
That's
so
great.
This trip to Hawaii has been amazing.
So that's our time. Thank you once again.
Thank you.